This is Planetary Radio.
メインエンジンスタート。
今メインエンジン ignition。
SRB 点火。
SRB ignition on
liftoff. With that liftoff from Japan, a new hope began its journey to Mars. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. What a week it was for space fans. We'll celebrate the successful launch of the United Arab Emirates mission to the Red Planet with members of the HOPE team, NASA Administrator Bridenstine, George Whitesides of Virgin Galactic, Ellen Stofan of the National Air and Space Museum, and others. Then we'll hear from leaders of the mission that discovered Comet Neowise, including Neowise Principal Investigator Amy Meinzer and NASA Planetary Defense Officer Lindley Johnson. And we've got Bruce Betts waiting for us with even more about how to see that comet and the other wonders lingering above us. Here are just two headlines from the July 17 edition of The Downlink, brought to you each week by the Planetary Society. Remember that dark green substance on the moon's far side that was inaccurately described as gel-like? Turns out it's probably just glassy rock, but this find by China's U-22 rover is still intriguing. Apollo astronauts found the same sort of deposit on the near side. It might have been formed in the heat of a volcanic eruption or a meteor impact. And by the way, by the time you hear this, it's possible that China's ambitious Mars mission, Tianwen 1, may be on its way to fourth rock. Speaking of the Moon and Mars, NASA has just relaxed planetary protection requirements for both bodies. The agency feared the old standards might have prevented eventual human exploration of the Red Planet. You can read more at planetary.org/downlink, where you'll also enjoy a beautiful image of Jupiter's moon Europa, captured years ago by Voyager 2. It was Sunday afternoon, July 19th, here on the California coast. I excused myself from my wife's socially distant birthday celebration so that I could join a different sort of party. The online event began about an hour before that launch of an H-2 rocket from the coast of Japan. His Excellency Yusuf Alotaiba, United Arab Emirates Ambassador to the United States, opened the webcast.
Good afternoon from Washington. For those of you in the U.S., thank you for joining us on a Sunday afternoon. And thanks to all our friends watching from the UAE around the world at this very late hour. Today, if all goes well, the UAE will become the first Arab country to launch an interplanetary spacecraft. This day has been years in the making. Many of you are likely familiar with President John F. Kennedy's moonshot speech. That speech inspired the American people to invest in space exploration and ultimately land the first humans on the moon. In 2014, we announced our own moonshot initiative. Our leadership challenged Emirati scientists and engineers to build a space probe and launch it into orbit around Mars in time for our 50th anniversary. It makes me so proud to see friends and colleagues gathered here today, 6 years later, to watch that dream become reality.
Also awaiting the launch of HOPE was NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine. Here's some of what he had to say.
Long before I was the NASA Administrator, even when I was in the House of Representatives, and you guys came to me and you said, hey, look, we have this big ambition. We just started a new space agency as the United Arab Emirates, and we're in fact going to go to Mars. And I remember thinking, wow, that's a stretch. And you gave me the timeline. And I remember thinking that this is going to be a very, very difficult challenge. And I don't know that at the time I fully believed that we would be in this moment right now. So I just want to say to start, congratulations. It has been, I know, not always easy. There's always challenges. This is space flight. But what an amazing job the United Arab Emirates has done putting together this mission and getting to this point. We've already seen the United Arab Emirates launch its own domestically produced satellite that is providing remote sensing and imagery on the Earth to understand our changing environment, KhalifaSat, which of course has been a great contributor to our understanding of our own planet. You've already had your first astronaut on the International Space Station. You've got plans for more astronauts on the International Space Station. The United States of America is very, very excited about having another partner in human spaceflight. And of course, our big project is to go to the moon. The United Arab Emirates, of course, has its own lunar mission that it's launching in 2022, which is going to be amazing. So I think this is a great moment, not just for the United Arab Emirates, but for the United States of America, and in fact, for all of the international partners that are involved in exploring space and sharing information. All of us can do more when we work together, and the United Arab Emirates is a shining example of what can be done when we do, in fact, work together. So we're grateful for the partnership. We look forward to the launch. When it comes to exploration and discovery, it transcends boundaries and it enables people to work together in ways that oftentimes is not easy. It keeps open a channel of communication. So I really do believe it is an amazing tool of diplomacy for all nations.
Remember, this was all before the successful launch, so you can understand the apprehension in the voice of Sara Al-Amiri. Sara chairs the United Arab Emirates Council of Scientists and is Minister of State for Advanced Sciences, but she's also science lead for what is formerly known as the EMM, the Emirates Mars Mission, and on August 1st, she will become president of the UAE Space Agency.
A collection of mixed feelings, from being terrified to being excited to apprehensive to, I just can't explain the multitude of emotions at the moment, especially reflecting on the large chunk that this has taken from our life. So everyone that has been on the mission, including our partners, this has been our every living, breathing moment. It has been part of our households, part of our families, part of our workplaces constantly. You get to a point in the mission where there's no such thing as day and night and work days and work weeks and so on. I think it's interesting in retrospect to see if this is going to create a void after launch, especially if the spacecraft is not here and it's on its journey. And let's see what the journey has in store for us.
The webinar was ably moderated by Talal Al-Kaisi of the UAE Space Agency. I first met Talal when he was assigned to the UAE Embassy in Washington.
I'd like to now turn to a very good friend of the UAE, Mr. George Whiteside, who was the CEO of Virgin Galactic until a few days ago, when he now has the coolest name in the, or coolest title in the space industry, the Chief Space Officer of Virgin Galactic, to share his experience in dealing with the UAE through the partnership Virgin Galactic and Mubadala Investment Company have. George?
Hi, Talal, and thank you for having us with you and everyone in the UAE space effort. It's such a great honor to be with you all and such an exciting moment. Yes, so our relationship with UAE has been going on for now over a decade, when we started a partnership around Virgin Galactic and its aspirations. And it's just been such an incredible pleasure and honestly a joy to watch the growth of the UAE space sector. As you pursue a very rational and logical series of steps to increase capacity within the country and to do real things, as the administrator and Mike Gold said, to really do a very well-planned agenda of real space activity. Our relationship on the Virgin Galactic side, you know, relates to potential growth of our business someday to the UAE, and there has been a spaceport or a potential spaceport location identified in the UAE, which has all the right parameters for a potential operation, as well as now the new space legal framework that the UAE has created, which enables those activities. And so that's what I mean about putting the blocks in place to, you know, really pursue a quite diverse range of activities, from science as today to human spaceflight and educational capacity building. It's just been a joy to watch the growth, and to be, you know, a small part of that that story has been terrific. And we're grateful to you, Talal, for the role you play as a diplomat within the space community to connect us all to the different things that UAE is working on.
I'll close our coverage of the beginning of the EMM Hope mission with a historical perspective from an old friend of Planetary Radio. Ellen Stofan leads the National Air and Space Museum in Washington. The planetary scientist is also a former chief scientist for NASA.
For me, the ambassador touched on it in the beginning. This, this whole program, and I've known Talal for now quite a number of years, and really watched this probe come to life. And it reminds me of another country 50 some years ago now, that in 8.5 years made it from basically no space agency at all to sending people to the moon. And that spirit of Apollo is what I have really watched happening in the UAE. And they will get the same results that we got from Apollo, inspiring a generation to go out and do the impossible. When you consider the people like Jeff Bezos, for example, who were inspired by Apollo, that's what's going to be happening in the UAE. Every school child is going to be watching Hope and saying, I want to be that first person to step on Mars.
As you heard, if all goes well, Hope will be inserted into its orbit above Mars in February of 2021. The same month, we'll see the arrival of China's Tianwen-1 and the Perseverance rover from NASA. What? You still haven't seen Comet Neowise? Apologies to our many Southern Hemisphere listeners who don't have this surprising visitor in the sky. As you'll hear when we talk with Bruce, I was finally able to see the comet a few days ago. It's called Neowise because it was discovered by that mission, and that mission is led by principal investigator Amy Meinzer. Amy has moved from the Jet Propulsion Lab to the University of Arizona, where she is a professor in the school's Lunar and Planetary Laboratory. Here are excerpts from her participation in a NASA teleconference just days ago.
This object was spotted in late March. On March 27th, we saw a series of images of it, and it was immediately obvious that it was pretty likely that this would be a comet based on the sort of extended emission, the sort of fuzz that we saw surrounding the point-like nucleus of the comet as it moved across the sky against the background stars. But when we first discovered these objects, we know so very little about them. We just see that there's something moving. In this case, we were able to call some friends who were able to contribute follow-up observations of the comet and determined that its orbit would actually take it fairly close to the sun, which immediately becomes pretty exciting for us because when something that's been frozen in deep space for a really long time gets close to the sun, a lot of exciting things can happen.
Amy Meinzer was joined in the telecom by her NEOWISE mission colleague, Emily Kramer. Emily is a co-investigator based at NASA JPL.
The comet is about 3 miles or 5 kilometers in diameter, which is reasonably large, but roughly average-sized comet. We're getting these spectacular images showing the comet's broad dust tail and ion trail in some cases as well. We should be able to see this comet for another few weeks or so, depending on how bright it stays. Comets are notoriously difficult to predict what's going to happen to them. We're all quite excited to see how this comet progresses. Because Comet Neowise is so bright, we're able to see it a lot more clearly than we do for many other comets. We're able to see it with a lot of different telescopes in different areas, and we're able to use different kinds of observations. So we're able to do spectroscopy as well as what we call photometry, which is measuring how bright an object is. We're also able to look at what we call its morphology, which means the shape. So comet tails tend to have a different shape as they move around away from the sun. So by studying this nice bright tail, we'll be able to get a better idea of what's going on in the comet's tail and understand the physics of comets.
I would add on to that, too, that one of the reasons we study comets like this one and why this one is so appreciated because it is so bright is that we really would like to know a lot more about their composition as well as their internal structure and how crumbly they are. We care about this because in the unlikely, extremely unlikely event that we would find a comet that is headed our way, we would like to know something about its structure and composition so we have a better idea of how to push it out of the way. One of the things we're interested in learning is sort of how crumbly or how strong the comet is on the inside. Is it fragmented on the inside? Does it break apart more easily when it gets heated up? So one of the things we'll be studying as we look at the dust signature from the object is the sizes of the particles that are coming off of its surface, and can we use that to understand the total mass of the object as well as how fast it's losing that mass by crumbling apart as it's being heated.
A few of us got to ask questions during the Comet Neowise telecom. I asked Emily Kramer if the up-close and personal observations of Comet 67P by the European Space Agency's Rosetta spacecraft have affected what we look for from a distance as other comets pass by.
It totally has reshaped our understanding of comets when we look at them from a distance. One of the really fascinating things that we discovered from the Rosetta mission is that many comets have what we call micro-outbursts, where they just let off a little bit of extra puff of activity every now and then. When we're observing from the ground, we might miss these if we're not looking closely for them. It's most of the time for comets where they're fairly quiescent. They don't do much anything particularly interesting. They get brighter, they get dimmer. Sometimes they let off a bit of a puff of extra activity. But Rosetta has showed us that these smaller puffs happen pretty frequently. And so we're now able to see that. We're tracking these objects more closely, and we're seeing a wider variety of activities than we had seen before.
Also in the telecom was another old friend of our show. Lindley Johnson has led NASA's Planetary Defense Office for years and has the great title of Planetary Defense Officer. I asked Lindley about the status of plans for a dedicated space-based infrared telescope that will search for and characterize near-Earth objects, those asteroids and comets that might threaten our planet.
Thanks for the question, Matt. We do have funding now in our Planetary Defense Program budget for a startup of a new space-based infrared telescope, a mission that we are calling the Near-Earth Object Surveillance Mission. We have funding this year, Congress designated for startup work on instrument development of about $35 million. And there is funding in fiscal year 21 as well, proposed for 21. Of course, the budget for 21 is still with Congress for appropriation. So we are hoping that their negotiations turn out well and we'll continue to have funding available.
I closed out my questions for all three of the telecom guests by asking if they had seen Comet Neowise with their own eyes.
Yes, it's actually been a really really big treat. I actually just went and looked at it a couple nights ago, and it was very low on the horizon, but I spotted it without binoculars. I was able to see it. It's really cool. I have to admit, it's really, really fun to see something that, you know, we see in a space telescope, right? And it looks like fuzzy dots when we first see it, of course, but there's really nothing quite like being able to see it with your own eyes and know that there really is something there. You know, it's very tangible, and that's pretty exciting. Plus, it's just beautiful. It's really fun to look at something like that.
I've gone to go see it a couple times in the morning when it was visible last week. The first one was just from right near Pasadena. We had a fantastic view of it rising up over the mountains. It was just, it gave me chills to see that, you know, knowing that our space telescope discovered that and that there is this object in space that we helped to find. It was really very exciting.
I'm waiting for the cloudy skies down here in Florida to clear in the evening. The last couple of evenings, we've had a big cloud bank of thunderstorms in that part of the sky. So got my fingers crossed that here in the next week we'll have clear skies and I'll be able to see it off my front deck here in Florida.
NASA's Lindley Johnson, joined by Neowise Principal Investigator Amy Meinzer and Neowise Co-Investigator Emily Kramer for a conversation about Comet Neowise. You can hear more from them and about the Emirates Mars mission at planetary.org/radio. We've also got a conversation with my colleague Casey Dreyer about the fascinating white papers he and Bill Nye have written and submitted to the National Academy's Planetary Science Decadal Survey. A brief break, and then I'll return with Bruce Betts. This is Planetary Radio.
Hi, Emily Lakdawala here with big news from the Planetary Society. We're rolling out a new membership plan with great benefits and expanded levels of participation. At the Planetary Society, passionate space fans like you join forces to create missions, nurture new science and technology, advocate for space, and educate the world. Details are at planetary.org/membership. I'll see you around the solar system.
Hey, Planetary Radio listeners, the Planetary Society now has an official online store. We've teamed up with Chop Shop, known for their space mission posters, to bring you space-inspired art and merchandise. You can find exclusive Planetary Society t-shirts, posters, and more. Visit planetly/spaceshop to learn more. That's planet.ly/spaceshop.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. So we are joined by the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. That's Bruce Betts. I think I told you, fourth try, and it wasn't as spectacular as the experience a lot of people have had, but I saw the comet. I saw Comet Neowise.
Yay!
Yeah, a lot of city lights and a lot of haze to look through. And without the binoculars, I never would have seen it. Thank goodness for my little astronomy app on my phone and my binoculars, because that made it not only possible, but really exciting, very enjoyable.
Good. Well, that's a good lead-in, because that's pretty much the deal with the comet is if you're in a city area, and I did my own suburban observing, it's tough to spot with the naked eye. It depends on how much haze and muck is in the atmosphere, but it's doing that thing where it's getting higher and higher every night in the evening west. This is Comet Neowise. Can probably see it, at least for a few more nights with just your eyes, but it'll be a lot easier if you follow the Matt Kaplan strategy and sweep the area. Preferably check a finder chart before you go out, because it does move from night to night. But it is for the next few days in Ursa Major, that also houses the asterism, the Big Dipper. It'll be below the Big Dipper. It's dimmer and dimmer, but you can still get it. Certainly from a dark site, you're still going to see it, and you can get nice pictures of it. So I had fun. Couldn't see it that well from a suburban environment, but with a camera and longer exposures, it was pretty.
Hey, if you want to share one of those pictures, we could put it on the show page.
Sure. Again, they're far more spectacular ones. I did get one with it over JPL, though, so I thought that was cool, since JPL operates the Neowise spacecraft that was used to discover Comet Neowise, and this was Comet Neowise over JPL. It was all very poetic, you might say.
Yeah.
You can check out super bright Jupiter over in the south in the early evening, and Saturn a little ways to its lower left. And Venus is dominating the pre-dawn east, looking super bright. There's no comet out there right now, or at least not Comet Neowise, but you can check out Venus looking spectacular.
Been a great week.
It has. Good stuff. All right, speaking of week... We move on to this week in space history. 1971, the launch of Apollo 15, successful mission to the moon with humans. And in 1984, Svetlana Savitskaya became the first female spacewalker.
Oh, yeah, I'd forgotten about that.
We move on to random space fact. So you may be familiar, Matt, with the Schwarzschild radius. The radius on a non-rotating spherical assumed black hole where the event horizon is. So anything past it, light doesn't escape, information doesn't get out. So Carl Schwarzschild accomplished solving for this and solving the Einstein field equations for general relativity in 1915 and 16 while he was serving in the German army in World War I and with an autoimmune disease, pemphigus, from which he passed away during 1916. But he got out this whole solution and such. And I want to read this amusing sentence from Wikipedia. The Schwarzschild solution, which makes use of the Schwarzschild coordinates and the Schwarzschild metric, leads to derivation of the Schwarzschild radius. Way to Schwarzschild.
Well done. Well done.
It's very Schwarzschild-y. So let's go on to the trivia contest. I asked you, who is the Bond albedo named after? And the Bond albedo is a reminder. Planetary scientists love it because it represents the amount of electromagnetic radiation across all parts of the spectrum, so not just visible light, how much gets reflected back from, in this case, a planet at all angles, planet, moon, whatever. So it's what is crucial in determining the radiation balance for a planetary body, how much radiation gets in compared to what gets reflected, blah, blah, blah. How'd we do, Matt?
Lots of entertaining and informative responses this week. Here's one from Gene Lewin, not our winner, one of our poets. Three mountains in the Granite State bear this surveyor's name, and work with his progenitor brought astronomical fame. They studied by telescopic means Saturn's surrounding heaven, discovering moon Hyperion, also known as Saturn 7. But we're looking for the namesake of the Bond albedo label. That would be George Philip Bond, not Fleming's Spy of Fable.
Creative. Like it.
And correct? George Philip Bond?
Yes, that is correct.
Well, that's going to make Aaron Ring very happy. Aaron is a first-time winner on the show. He's up in beautiful Stockton, California. I shouldn't laugh there. It's not a bad town. He said, indeed, it was George Bond. He also says, hi, Matt. Hi, Bruce. Love the show. Aaron, we hope you're going to love your beautiful Planetary Radio t-shirt. Wear it proudly as you walk the streets of Stockton, California.
Hey, will you? Stop hating on Central Valley cities from the guy who grew up in Sacramento. Stockton's a lovely place. I mean, you know, it's no Sacramento, but it's delightful. And it's flat and it has a lot of trees. And those two things make me very happy.
I knew it was in your backyard as a kid. And I was hoping you would react to my subtle put downs of Stockton and the Central Valley. We got more. It's true, as we heard from Laura Dodd, and you could tell from the poem, astronomy ran in the Bond family. Father William, cousin Edward Holden, also spent a lot of time looking at the night sky. A whole bunch of features in the solar system bear their names. And then there were all the other Bond jokes. John Guyton in Australia and Mark Little in Northern Ireland both came up with, basically, they could have told us whether or not he had a license to kill, but then they'd have to, you know.
All right. We talked about Carl Schwarzschild, who solved the Einstein field equations for the geometry of empty space-time around a non-rotating, uncharged, barking, axially symmetric black hole with a quasi-spherical event horizon. Here's your question. Who first solved those equations for all those same conditions except for a rotating black hole? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Oof, you have until the 29th. That'd be Wednesday, July 29 at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us this answer and win yourself. We're going to give you the choice again. Either a Planetary Society 40th anniversary t-shirt or a vintage Planetary Society t-shirt with our original Clipper Ship logo, partially designed at least by our co-founder, Carl Sagan. Those are both available in the Planetary Society store, planetary.org/store, or just go to chopshopstore.com because that's where all of our merch is. Good luck with this one. By the way, the Schwarzschild radius, not to be confused with the Schwarzenegger radius, right? Which is whatever, I think 13 inches around a bicep.
No, very, very different. Very different.
I'm sorry. We're done.
All right, everybody. Go out there, look up the night sky, and think about what you'd like to put behind the event horizon of a black hole. Thank you, and good night.
How about our old refrigerator, which is about to be replaced? That'd be a good thing to throw behind the event horizon.
We can do that.
Well, I'm going to get that help from the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, Bruce Betts, who joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its members who know every week is Space Week. Here's something fun. We are proud to welcome the lucky listeners to WTJX FM 93.1, NPR in the Virgin Islands. I think we need a studio there, don't you? Mark Hilverde is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. Stay well. Ad Astra.